Welcome to the Math Ed Podcast. My name is Sam Otten from the University of Missouri, and back on the podcast with me is Chris Jett, who's an associate professor of math education, but Chris is now at Georgia State University in the College of Education and Human Development. So Chris, thanks for coming back on the podcast.
Yes, thank you for having me again.
We're going to be talking about Chris's new book that was published by Teachers College Press, and it's Black Male Success in Higher Education: How the Mathematical Brotherhood Empowers a Collegiate Community to Thrive. So, Chris, congratulations first on the book. I'm sure it's exciting to see it out in the world.
Oh, yes, Lord, it is. Thank you.
So this book is it's a deep ethnographic study where you follow and you were, you know, kind of in community with 16 Black men who were mathematics majors. And so the book goes through a lot of details about their journey, their experiences, their camaraderie, all that thing, being Black math majors. But before we get there, you start out the book by sharing a little bit about yourself and how you, as a young Black man, you know, were getting into mathematics. I wonder if you want to just also share a little bit of that here about how you found yourself coming into mathematics and your mathematical successes that are part of your story.
Yes. One thing that I mentioned in the book, I kind of start with my dad, because if you let him tell, he has so many stories about, you know, just learning addition and counting in your hands and, you know, all the fun things we do as children, but how they really sort of laid the foundation for my mathematics education or my mathematics success. And so I'm the oldest of three. So my younger brother and sister also kind of played a role in that. And what I mean by that is that because I was the oldest, I always wanted to help with homework. We would play school. And so, of course, you know, we're playing school. I'm the leader or I'm the teacher and helping them with math, that sort of thing. And so that math sort of teaching identity sort of stuck with me throughout that. I'll add that I grew up in a duplex. So we were on one side of the duplex, and our neighbor was on the other side, who I call my Aunt Minnie. I mean, she's technically not, I mean, she's my, I call her my Aunt Minnie, but, you know, she was my neighbor. But the special thing about her is that she also had children. And so when we'd all get together, again, with me being sort of the helm or the oldest of them all, I sort of would help her children as well. And so that's a little bit about this story. You know, she's the one who gave me the nickname Professor as a kid. And so just this is like a full circle moment just for her to see me to actually become a professor for her children. You know, I mean, because a lot of them are like my Facebook friends and things like that. And so for them to say, oh, my God, like, you're really a professor. Like, we used to call you that as a kid, that sort of thing. And so it's a great feeling associated with it.
Yeah, definitely the feeling of support, the feeling of people seeing, like, believing in you and seeing where you could go. And then, yeah, now having that actually come to be the case with the later success in math and becoming a professor. So, yeah, yes. It was really cool to hear about the family support, community support. And in your story in the book, you talk about how at school, it was a little bit of a mixed, you know, experience, like some teachers that were very supportive and very inspiring, but also some teachers that you felt like maybe didn't believe in you or didn't sort of lift you up in the same way. So school, to me, I read it as school kind of mixed, but your community was very positive, very empowering, like that sort of thing.
Yes. And I'm glad you mentioned it about school, because even with the participants, you know, some of them had some of the same successes and quote unquote challenges with schooling environments. And most of the time, you know, it was pointed towards white teachers. And so, yeah, that's an interesting dynamic as well.
Yeah, it's kind of a theme that goes throughout the book.
Yeah.
And something that, you know, for myself as a white educator, I want to think about more and reflect on more. So I appreciate that. Help us set the stage, though. So the setting of the book and the participants that you spent the time with was at Morehouse College. So I wonder if you could just tell us a little bit about Morehouse College as a setting. And then you also have this idea of mathematical brotherhood as sort of a conceptual frame for this work. So I wonder if you could just set the stage for us a little bit.
So Morehouse is right on, it's like, I guess you consider it like southwestern part of Atlanta. And so Morehouse is the only HBCU of its kind. So what I mean by that is the only all male, quote unquote, you know, or a lot of people say like traditionally single gendered institution. And it's really dedicated, you know, the entire mission is to educating and empowering Black men. A lot of times people hear maybe about like Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. because, you know, he's one of the celebrated alum from Morehouse. Sometimes folks hear like Dr. Benjamin E. Mays. There are a lot of other prominent like Morehouse alumni within the city of Atlanta. And so when you think about Morehouse, it's sort of the quote unquote space for Black male education. And of course, that transfers to mathematics as well. And so the second part of your question about mathematical brotherhood, so Morehouse's mission, it's they call it like an it's an institutional brotherhood. And so I just sort of borrowed from that and sort of added on like this whole idea of mathematical brotherhood. And so mathematical brotherhood is really what I'm arguing is the central theme of the book. Actually, when I wrote the book proposal for Teachers College Press, the working title, that's what I was going to call the book, like the Mathematical Brotherhood. And then, I realized it included so much more, and we were trying to capture all of this, what I was trying to do with community and Black male success and higher ed. And so that's why the title, which I think is a little long, but it captures all of that. So what I'm arguing for is like I said, this concept of mathematical brotherhood. You know how we talk about like asset-based work within the field. So it's applying this to Black men. And so, we're thinking about this Black men as a collective and how they persist within the major. So if I think about brotherhood, like I think about my own brother, my brother and I have agreements and disagreements, we still have sibling rivalry, like even as adults. And I also kind of liken it to this also like fraternal connection. And I kind of talk about that a little bit in the book as I conceptualize it, how this group of math majors sort of functions as a fraternity, so to speak. So yeah, that's what I'm arguing in the book when I mention mathematical brotherhood.
Yeah. And then, of course, in the book, you get a lot more of the details of what all goes into that, all the different dynamics. I think I like the family analogy that you made there too, because you can see that they really support each other and they do have a deep care as like a group, but they also have a little bit of rivalry. They have a little bit of like, hey, my solution's better than yours. Like they push each other to like higher heights, with a little bit of competitive edge. But that makes sense if you think of it in a brotherhood kind of frame.
Yes, indeed.
Now, your methodology here, you describe it as a mixture of ethnography and also portraiture. And so I wonder if you could just tell us what does that mean, or how did that play out in this study that you're doing ethnography and portraiture? And I'm just kind of curious, what was your schedule like? Like, how did you actually make this happen? Because it seemed like you got pretty deeply embedded and saw a lot of interviews, but also saw some of the interactions. And so just let us know a little bit about how you were able to collect the data for this book.
So I guess if you go back to ethnography, it comes from the anthropological tradition, and I know it's very popular among math education researchers who use qualitative, methods within their work will often use ethnography. But in brief, ethnography, it's just the study of people within a particular setting, their behaviors, their perspectives, so on and so forth. And so what ethnographers do is embed themselves within this setting to produce thick descriptions, if I can borrow from that qualitative work, but pretty much it's just these accounts of these particular events. And so using ethnography, I conjoin that with portraiture. And so I'm like, well, these are more so like portraits of these particular episodes, experiences, and which is really hard to do, within this page limit. I will say I was over the work, and let me back up a little bit about me. Let's say, for instance, I need to write something that's 10,000 words. I struggle with getting to 10,000 words. And so if I'm writing a journal article and I'm never the type of person to go over. That's my point. So for me to go over with the word count was really interesting. And I think it was so much so because, how powerful the story is and, how much I believe in the work and that sort of thing and the one opportunity to get it right. But going back to your question about, portraiture. Portraiture pretty much seeks to document like what works well. I attempted to do that with that book, primarily through the use of voice. And voice is a hallmark of portraiture, as I argue within the book.
Yeah, and so how often were you out there?
At Morehouse. Yeah, so I was there. So Thursday was my data collection day. So I'll go back. So of course, I was at the University of West Georgia at the time. And University of West Georgia is a very traditional undergraduate institution. So, I would have class like Monday, Wednesday, Friday. And so Thursday was typically the quote unquote research day. So it was literally waking up, and just going there as my work for the day and just staying there the entire day. The good thing was that like they had like the colloquium series on Thursdays. They had a lot of events
Yeah, it seemed like you were there on the right day. Yeah.
Oh yeah, I was there on the right day. It was a perfect day. And actually, I mean, there's so much that I didn't even include in the book, like I said, because of space limitations. So that worked out well. And I have to give Dr. Cooper, so Dwayne Cooper, who worked the fort to the book, department chair at Morehouse at the time, he was very instrumental with helping me to, think about, their schedules and, exams and, oh, come at this time, this day, or, make sure you attend this event on this day, that sort of thing. And so that really helped out as well.
Yeah. And then that was for the whole academic year, right?
That was for the whole academic year. And I will say there were some weekend events too, of course, like there's homecoming. I think I mentioned like the Morehouse Mathematics Breakfast. That was actually at the end of the academic year. But I really enjoyed that because I also got to meet like some of the parents and some of the other family members of the math majors. And so it was a great sort of research experience.
Well, let's get to the 16 black men that are the math majors that you built this relationship with, and you're doing this portraiture with them. And of course, we're just barely going to touch on some of the great detail and the great nuance of the book, but I am happy to hear from you about a little bit of it. I wanted to start just first of all, you have a variety of stories about how these young black men came to Morehouse College and also how they decided to major in mathematics. So like in some cases there was like a very early inspiration, like from elementary school, but then there was others where it was like upper high school, like almost towards the end of their high school where they had a good math class, or they sort of had, oh wait, maybe mathematics could actually be my thing. So I wonder if you just want to share some of those pathways that came to life in terms of how they got to Morehouse College in the first place.
So I think the K-12, so it's a little bit of both, like K-12 and the sort of family dynamic. I like the family dynamic because it sort of disrupts like these stereotypes about like black families or maybe black parents and family members not being involved with their children's education, this sort of thing. And I think the K-12 thing is because of the math teachers. It's funny, I just had a class last night with a group of math teachers. A lot of times, high school math teachers, sometimes maybe they need a reminder of how impactful they really are in spite of the challenges they perceive to have. Or maybe I should say sometimes they don't get to see maybe the fruits of their labor and that sort of thing. And so listen to these guys talk about like some of their K-12 math teachers. I was like, oh, sometimes like teachers also need to hear this too, as a way to sort of go on and realize like their work is not in vain. But to answer the question, yeah, some of those K-12 environments, it was just interesting to hear, like even as a math educator myself, to hear like, oh, this particular thing that happened in a secondary math classroom really inspired me. And it sort of set it off that I would go major in math. And so definitely those K-12 experiences and those home experiences. I also add one interesting thing that I found within the study is that the people who were the students who were in other disciplines primarily came from the dual degree program. So I thought that was an interesting finding because the dual degree program there, you spend a few years at Morehouse. And then you go a couple of years to another institution that has an engineering program. Well, one is sort of revealed, like, I guess the challenges associated with the dual degree engineering program, primarily being like how long it is to complete. And then also, I think for me, it just sort of showed how mathematically talented dual degree students are. And I mean, that's no surprise because, if you're, engineering or whatever, this sort of thing, you have some mathematical talents. But, just thinking of a way to just looking at Morehouse and what they're doing and the great things that they're doing as faculty to help the students, and that the students decided to go to the mathematics major, speak volumes with that. Yeah.
Yeah, and that definitely did seem to be what drew some of them in. They weren't just going to major in math, they like really wanted to go to Morehouse. That's part of some of their stories. But that's where I wanted to go next, was into Morehouse, into the math department. So in the book, you were able to observe a lot of things that were going on in the Morehouse math department. You talk about the faculty. There's faculty who themselves are like Morehouse grads, but there's other faculty as well. There's the students, there's clubs, alumni that are involved. There's extra events, there's the breakfast, there's their there's this third floor respect, which was kind of an interesting notion of the community. I wonder if you could just, I know you can't cover all of that, people have to read the book, but are there just a couple things that you want to comment on about the math department and what they have going on there?
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned third floor respect because I really like third floor respect. As a matter of fact, the only article I published from this, so I have a piece in the Journal of Higher Education where I talk about this idea of third floor respect, and I entitled the article, third floor respect. Yeah, and so third floor respect is it's their sort of comical way to have fun with mathematics, but also to challenge math majors and to also just make sure that folks are coming, what is that? Coming correct is how we say it. So to come to correct means that you're on top of things with your mathematics. You're mathematically astute. Your proofs are on point, so to speak. So the third floor respect is a phenomenon that I really enjoyed, and it's good that the student arrived, and it's interesting to see how they take hold of it.
And just also to clarify, the third floor is like the home base for where the students hang out and like where, yeah.
Oh yeah, great point. Yeah, the third floor, it's a three-story building, it's the third floor of the building, and so yeah, it's a brilliant idea in my opinion. So yeah, on the third floor there is the math lab. It's a study space. I really like the math lab and what it represents, like the arrangement of it, the pictures, just to see the guys in there doing the mathematics. That's pretty cool. I actually so ironically I was at Morehouse is within the Atlanta University Center. Morehouse is within the AUC, and I was just there for the Asa Hilliard Symposium. And so it's like every time I go to the AUC, I stop by the math lab just to see, just to see folks doing, and just to kind of reminisce on this particular study. And maybe one other thing is the alumni conference. So I think the alumni conference started from, I think, like an NSF grant or something they had, and it was just something that just sort of continued. I think they didn't do it the year of COVID or something. I don't know where they are with it. I don't want to say the wrong thing with it. But the alumni conference is a nice way to bring the graduates back and sort of inspire the current students to think about, whether it's grad school, industry, government, whatever the case may be, in different ways. I think it's also a way to showcase what you can do with a mathematics degree.
Yeah, and it makes it feel like you're part of something bigger, that reaches back to other generations, to other alumni. And then yeah, I mean, it definitely did seem to have inspiration for graduate school. Like, I mean, it was a pretty surprising number of people that were thinking about graduate school or considering, a wide range of options. So it seems like what Morehouse is building in the broader community that goes even beyond campus inspires the young men in like what their possibilities are and things.
Yes.
So one of the, big things to mention is, that you are focusing on the Black men, you are in an HBCU kind of setting, and you do an analysis of the space in the math department, broadly speaking, the space, and how it's a race-affirming space in contrast to some of the other experiences that the students were telling you about where they felt that they were marginalized or they felt that they were oppressed or had negative experiences. But at Morehouse, it was more of a race-affirming space. I wonder if you could just tell us some of the ways that your analysis kind of revealed that race-affirming aspect.
So that was sort of derived from sort of what was going on within a broader society. So I mean, of course, what happened with 2020 with George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, and this sort of thing. So all those discussions. And so I was thinking about, okay, well, I definitely need a chapter on race. So all this is happening in like 2020, and I'm trying to write this and this sort of thing. And so it's
Wow.
like, we're drafting this, and then you write something, you're like, well, this doesn't really capture what Morehouse is. And so it's like, well, how do I weave in what's happening with their racialized experiences, so to speak, but also capture what's happening in Morehouse? And so that's sort of the impetus for that. And so what I was thinking about, so there's a lot now talking about like things like anti-racist pedagogy, and people have been thinking about, okay, well, what can we do to, attract and make sure that Black students persist and at whatever higher ed institutions. And so just thinking about that, I'm like, oh, it needs to be sort of like this racially affirming space. And so when I think about it, that's sort of what I had in mind. And when I was thinking about it within the context of Morehouse, It was, these guys being around a critical mass of Black scholars. And so, just looking at how this really enhanced their self-efficacy, how it really motivated them to persist in the field. So that's sort of what I was thinking about generally. I will say one thing the students mentioned, and I didn't get to include a lot of this in the book. Like I said, as you know, the thing is, once you publish these things, you're like, oh, I should have done this, or as you think about it, I should have done that. But I did capture just a little bit about like how they would say like people would visit campus, whether it was alumni or employers for career fairs, and how they were like always encouraged and affirmed and that sort of thing. And so, yeah, it just seemed like there's something special going on at Morehouse in that regard.
Yeah. So you were situating this in the broader context of like society grappling with how can we better support people? How can we, avoid marginalization? How can we be empowering for, all races? So in that spirit, trying to draw lessons from this book out into other contexts and more broadly, you talk in the book about how there's not simple solutions. You can't just take something that Morehouse does and just replicate it. And it's not as simple as, oh, just copy that and it will work out the same. There's so much context, there's so much history, there's so many nuances that it's not as easy as like duplicating things that are in the book. But there are still lessons to be had. So I wonder if just in your mind, as other people are reading this or you're talking to people about the book, what are some of the lessons that you hope can go beyond Morehouse College and can go to other contexts?
Yeah. So a couple of things, definitely like with the third floor respect, I think at the heart of that is this idea of respect. And so, as we think about like affirmations and encouraging students, motivating students, that sort of thing. And so I think that respect goes a long way, especially in the Black community in general, and with Black men in particular. People want to be respected. They want to feel like their humanity is respected, their ideas are respected, their contributions are respected. And so I think that respect is sort of one big takeaway.
And to me, the interesting thing is that respect also comes with like challenging each other or pushing each other to like your best performance. So there's like high standards, but also it is on respect. It's on a foundation of respect.
Yes, I appreciate that. And another thing, thinking about the faculty, when I was writing this up, I was like, oh, it would have been interesting to hear the faculty members' perspectives about this. And of course, like I said, the chapter where I talk about the faculty is from the students' perspective. And so, as a takeaway, to your point about, as we think about like hiring decisions and we think about people who are going to be dedicated and committed to student success, I think that captures that. But yeah, it would have been interesting to see faculty perspectives. I don't know, maybe someone will do a study about faculty perspectives of students, that sort of thing. Maybe one other thing, maybe for math educators, as we think about Black boys, whether it's K-12 or maybe I should say K-16, so Black boys and men, just recognizing their mathematical brilliance, going back to like Leonard and Martin's work. And recognizing it, how Black families are an asset, and the Black community is an asset, and just really drawing from those assets to improve mathematics teaching and learning.
I'm speaking with Chris Jedd about his book, Black Male Success in Higher Education. And I mentioned earlier, and we talked before about Georgia State University. So you're at Georgia State now. I know the last time you were on the podcast, you were at West Georgia. You spent, I think, like roughly 10 years at University of West Georgia, I think it is.
Yeah, it was 10 years.
Yeah, awesome. But I know previous to that, your grad school was in Georgia State. So now you're sort of back at Georgia State as an associate professor. I just wonder, how does it feel at Georgia State? How's it feel being back there? How's Atlanta?
So, it feels great, I will say, to be back. Atlanta is Atlanta, all the big buildings. I can't remember who, somebody's like, it's like the New York of the South. I think it might have been a historian or a sociologist. I don't want to misquote there. But it feels great to be there. There are a lot of opportunities, perhaps more opportunities for research and collaboration, given that it is a research space. And we are dealing with some challenges with math teacher candidates. I think that's a national problem, so I think that's not unique to Georgia State, but it's a great space. I will say my students looked outside and they saw Kevin Hart. They're filming some movie. They're always filming movies in Atlanta, so you always
Yeah.
see. So it's very commonplace to see celebrities in Atlanta, which is another thing I have to get used to, and like to keep walking and acting like, it's the thing. And so yeah, you have things like that, which is sort of unique and fun and exciting too.
Yeah, well, congrats on the new position. That sounds great.
Yes, thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Math Ed podcast, and I want to close this episode by sharing some news about the University of Missouri. We are hiring 2 open rank professors on the tenure track in math education. And so the first exciting thing about this is that we're hiring 2 scholars at the same time. But the second exciting thing here is that we have endowments for both of these positions. The Richard Miller position has a roughly $2 million endowment to support the research of that scholar. And the Lucy Fields Gallup Endowment is new, and it also has a roughly $2 million endowment to back the research efforts and the professional initiatives of that faculty scholar. Our college and our Department of Learning, Teaching, and Curriculum have a particular interest in scholars who are using justice-oriented frameworks, or they're examining intersections of math education and policy, or maybe intersections with the learning sciences, particularly if they have an interest in issues of equity in pre-K to 12 settings. And we also might be interested in people who are doing research that relates to rural education contexts. But really, we're just excited to support and collaborate with scholars who have active research agendas. And it is also a chance to come and live in Columbia. It's a Midwestern city of about 130,000 people, right in the middle of Missouri, halfway between St. Louis and Kansas City. Niche.com and Livability.com both rank Columbia as one of the best places to live in the United States. So if you're interested in learning more about the position or the opportunities here, you can contact our search committee chair, who's a faculty member colleague of mine, John Lannan. So his email address is lannanj@missouri.edu, and we're going to officially begin reviewing applications on November 1st.